Hi, everyone. Thank you, Gary. I really, really appreciate that introduction. You are awesome. And thank you, Kenny. I'm very honored that you asked me to share my story again tonight. Before I get started, I just want to remind you guys that because of the weird weather we've been having here, I'm not too confident about my connection. So what I'm going to do is, as the Spirit moves me, I am going to share and share, and hopefully I can get this through without getting disconnected. Okay, so now that we have that out of the way, you all know that my name is Lulu, and I am a very grateful, blessed, very blessed, recovering nicotine junkie. I started smoking very young. In fact, I was thinking about it earlier, laying across my bed earlier, giving this some thought, and how each and every time I've ever given my share, it's been different. So I don't expect this to be anywhere out of that realm. But I started smoking. I took my first cigarette at 16 years old. I was with my best friend, and she had decided that she was going to, for whatever reason, steal one of her sister's cigarettes. And I was very much a part of that, don't get me wrong. I mean, I helped her to plot on the day, the time. I was all the way in, right? Didn't know what I was getting myself into, but you know, I was very at 16 years old, I was rather defiant. You know, I grew up in a household where I always felt like I just didn't really matter. You know, I felt like, first of all, there were 10 of us siblings, right? My mom had 6 girls and 4 boys. And so I always felt like, because I was the middle child, I had these 5 siblings over me who were always bossing me around and telling me what to do, and what I said didn't really matter much of anything, at least not when I was a kid, right? And then I had 4 siblings under me, and as I got a little older and a little bit smarter, I started doing what the older siblings did to me. I started bossing those guys around. So I was pretty defiant, and, you know, I just wanted to have my way and do things the way I wanted to do at 16. And so when my friend and I decided we were going to take that cigarette, boy, I'm telling you, it's funny now that I think about it, you know, like, the way that we decided to do that, and the way we put that together was just really sneaky, and it was just really, I don't even have the word for it, but I was all in it. I'm going to tell you that I was all in. Most of the time, I was the instigator in our relationship. You know, in my household, I didn't feel like I had much of a voice, but on the outside is where I tended to have more of a say-so. For whatever reasons, my friends tended to allow me space enough to, you know, do what I wanted to do. And, you know, I was making good grades and all that kind of stuff, so I guess a lot of my friends looked up to me, right? But I felt very defiant. I felt sick and tired as early as 15, 16 years old, because, you know, I was the one child who was always very sick physically, and I just did not like that. You know, I had my menstrual cycle, and unlike any of my 5 sisters, I was always sick every single month without fail, starting at 13 years old. Whenever my cycle would start, I was laid up in bed sick for 3-4 days straight, where I'd miss school. I couldn't do anything, sick. And I just didn't like it. I didn't understand it either. My mom, as awesome as a woman as she was, and, you know, she really did her best, her and my dad, you know, but my mother didn't talk to me about what was going on with me other than to say, oh, Lulu, don't worry about it. I was the same way when I was your age. You'll grow out of it. But, you know, that wasn't good enough for me. I was thinking like I was the cursed child. You know, it's like I'm looking at my sisters and they're going on with their lives as they have their menstrual cycles also. So it didn't make sense to me. Why is it that Lulu has to be the one who's sick? And I didn't like that. I didn't like the attention that I got. I didn't like the fact that everyone in the family had to know that I was ill. And everyone in my school, you know, my mom would have to go to school and get my homework and communicate with the teachers. Oh, Lulu won't be, you know, in school for the next 3 or 4 days because of her menstrual cramps. It's just like I felt like my life was an open book at 15 years old. And I was tired. I didn't know how to deal with the pain. And it was really awful. I'm talking awful. I've never known any other woman in my lifetime who has suffered menstrual cramps the way that I did. And I just got tired of being in pain. And when I took that first cigarette, I clearly remember, you know, I guess I wanted to not feel pain so badly that I fooled myself and told myself that the cigarette, as awful as it was the first time, and I coughed and hacked like crazy, like most smokers do the first time, and said I'd never do it again. I swore right after smoking it, I'll never do this again, but that didn't last long. But, you know, I fooled myself, right? I told myself that, yeah, maybe it does make me feel a little better, and maybe I can forget about the horrible cramps and the pain, you know, of living in a family where, you know, my dad was being, at this point, he was very verbally abusive. You know, that's what I grew up with. People didn't talk about their feelings. Like in my family, and I'm not trying to throw my parents under the bus, don't get me wrong. My mother was a devout Baptist woman. My mother was a God-fearing, loving woman, a beautiful woman on the inside as well as out. She was beautiful. And my dad, he wasn't too bad on the eyes either. But my dad, you know, he grew up under a father who was very stern. And so my dad did a lot of yelling and screaming and cursing. And, you know, I just got tired of it, man, and I couldn't say anything. You know, it's like I had to walk around as if I didn't have feelings, but I did. I felt some kind of way about the way he was treating my mother. I never saw him physically abuse her, but, you know, growing up in a family where there was rampant verbal abuse, I came to the conclusion very early on that abuse, it hurts. It doesn't matter that he wasn't using his fist to smack her around. He was belittling her, and he belittled each and every muscle. And he just didn't know any better. He thought that because that's the way he was raised, that's how he had to raise. He would always say to me, you know, I have to spare the rod. And I didn't know what the heck he was talking about, but growing up in my family wasn't easy at all. It wasn't easy at all. There I was, always physically sick. Emotionally, I was quite bothered by what was going on. But because my parents didn't really know the depths of the abuse by my dad, they didn't really make much of that. You know, nothing was made of that. It was almost as if that was normal in our household. In fact, it was very normal. You know, there was lots of dysfunction. And like I said, I just got tired of the pain. On top of all that, I lost my brother when I was very early. I think this was a little bit past 16 years old. One summer, he was gunned down two doors away from where we lived. And now we had been in this home like forever. And so it was just quite bothersome to me that my brother could be shot and killed literally two doors away from where we grew up, where we played. And that hurt me. And I did not know how to deal with that. I didn't have a platform in which to express my grief. I didn't see my mother express hers. She didn't show us any examples of how to deal with things. Her way of dealing with things was to just pray and keep going. That's what she would say to me. I pray and I just keep my head up and I keep going. And so that's what I was used to, but, you know, I got tired of that. I really, really did. And I went on and I went on doing everything that I saw my mother doing, and my older siblings. They were very instrumental in the way that I felt and the way that I acted. At this time, 16, almost 17 years old, my two other older brothers, there were four of them, right? Well, my brother Wooly, he started smoking very early, and I always looked up to him, especially after Elijah was shot and killed. I looked up to Wooly, and Wooly was maybe like 6 years older than me, and, you know, he had all these girlfriends, just really a handsome dude, and, you know, he was cool, right? He had all the friends and that kind of thing, and he was a smoker, and I used to think, this is really cool, you know. I would think to myself, because I couldn't tell anyone then, right? I would be in serious trouble if I had said anything like that. So I kept it to myself, but I really did admire my older brother and the fact that he smoked, and the guys that he hung around with were all smokers. And I would catch myself, you know, staring out of the window and watching them when they didn't know I was watching. In other words, I was just really smitten and really taken by nicotine quite early, well before I became addicted to it. Back in the 60s, they had these big billboards everywhere, and they'd have these beautiful women up on them, right? And they almost always have a cigarette hanging from their mouth. And, you know, I'd look in the magazines and on television, and smoking was just really glamorized back then. And I fell really hard. I fell right in, you know, and like I said, it was well before I started actually smoking full time. But that would only last up until I was about 19 years old, fresh out of high school, and I met my first boyfriend, the first guy I fell madly, and I mean madly, in love with, and this guy would later become my husband. And he was, you know, much like my dad, you know, physically, you know, a very tall, handsome, charismatic gentleman. I mean, all the girls thought he was drop-dead gorgeous, and I just knew he was, and I felt like, wow, I can't believe that this guy is actually paying me any attention, and, you know, he wants to be with me. And so I got with him, and I fell really deeply in love with this guy, and he was a big-time smoker, right? And so it wasn't long after meeting him that I tried one of his cigarettes, and it was almost like instantly that feeling that I remember having when I was 16 years old with my friend. I remember those feelings coming back, and I thought, wow, this is really awesome. This is really, really awesome, you know, and I want to continue to do this because I really like this guy, and I know I'm going to marry him, and I want to be just like him. I guess I really didn't have much of an identity back then, and I was following, you know, I was following other people that I thought was what I wanted to be, when really I had no idea back then what the hell I was doing. I didn't know who I was or what my purpose here in this life was. I was just following people. And so I ended up getting married, and I was married all of 10 years. It was a very, it started out really, really cool. You know, my husband, he was just awesome in the beginning, or at least that's how it appeared, right? He would take me out to some of the nicest places. We were dressing a lot. I mean, we just were a really flashy, nice-looking couple. But soon enough, behind closed doors, that all changed very quickly. It was like I woke up one morning and didn't realize who the heck I was married to. This guy, I thought to myself, he's not the guy that I married. This guy, I mean, he looks like him. He looks very much like him, but he just started to act really possessive. And he became very, very controlling. And shortly after that, he became physically abusive. I mean, this guy, I was in that marriage and I was physically abused. I was emotionally abused and tortured almost on a daily basis. It got to the point that nicotine was what I reached for every time I felt the pain, you know, and I'm talking physical and emotional pain. So nicotine at this point, again, I'm thinking that it's really helping me. You know, it's helping me to avoid the pain, or, you know, I knew that I was in a bad way. I was in a bad marriage, but somehow having the nicotine made it seem less traumatic, if that makes any sense. I used nicotine a lot at that point to cover a lot of my emotions that I was not equipped to deal with. I had never been taught how to acknowledge or how to deal with my emotions. And I didn't learn until much, much later, after I got the strength to divorce my husband and leave him. I didn't learn until after that the truth is something that can set you free, but you need to recognize the lies that are actually holding you hostage before you can do that. And so I'm telling you, I went through hell in a handbasket, but I finally did get out of that bad marriage. But all during the time that I was there, it was like nicotine was my best friend, you know, and I was very much so addicted at that point, highly addicted to nicotine. I couldn't even get out of bed in the morning without needing to turn over. Before my feet would even hit the floor, I'd be reaching for the pack of cigarettes. You know, I can remember fights. We had a lot of fights over nicotine, you know, over cigarettes. You know, I would accuse my husband of not making enough money to keep up with to keep my nicotine supply plentiful, and he would accuse me of smoking too much. I mean, we just had crazy, insane arguments and fights over nicotine, of all things. But at that point, I was very, very much into my addiction. It dawned on me the other night, guys, and I have to apologize. I know I'm probably all over the place here, but I'm just going to try my very best to paint you a picture of exactly what it was like for me. It was bad. It was pretty bad. Nicotine was the first drug that I picked up, and that's why I tell people today, nicotine was the gateway drug for me. I don't know about anyone else, but nicotine was the first drug to come into my life, and it was the last drug. But in between there, from the beginning to the ending, there were other drugs, And I know this is Nicotine Anonymous, but I have to be honest here, and I'm not going to get really deep into it, but there were a lot of other drugs in the middle. You know, I found myself turning to cocaine. I was doing cocaine almost as often as I was smoking nicotine, alcohol. I mean, bottles and bottles and of alcohol and beer and anything that I could get my hands on, right? Because I'm still trying to escape the pain. Even after I got out of the horrible abusive marriage, I didn't go for counseling or anything, right? So I was still hurting, and I did not know just how much. But, you know, I turned to other drugs. I held on to the nicotine, though, no matter what. Many years I dibbled and dabbled in other recreational and abusive of drugs, to the point where I had to go to my older sisters and say, hey, look, life has gotten way out of control for me, and I need to go somewhere, a rehab, a rehabilitation place, somewhere to try and get myself together, because you guys are losing me here, and I don't know if you know it, but I felt like I was losing myself, you know. And by this time, I have three children. I'm looking at my little kids get older, and I'm just all the way out of control. So I went into a rehab, and I got myself clean and sober. And I stayed that way for a very long time before I would end up relapsing on drugs again. And nicotine, again, was always right there. No matter what was going on, it was there. I was way in. I was way in over my head. I could not do anything. You know, I didn't know how to live life. I didn't know how to express myself. I just didn't know anything, but I knew how to use nicotine. And so that was my drug of choice. It always has been. Again, it was the first thing that came into play for me, and it was the last thing to go, day after day after day. And before you know it, I looked up, and I was counting a little bit past 30 years that I had given my life over to nicotine. And I mean, I had really given my heart, soul, everything about me. I had turned my life over to nicotine. And I did a lot of crazy things to keep up with the addiction, you know, like stealing from other people, taking other people's money, manipulating guys. I was real good at that, manipulating men for money. And, you know, I did a lot of things I'm not proud of, but it's the truth, man. I was willing to do whatever I had to do to get my hands on my drug of choice. You know, I lied, I stole, you know, I smoked repeatedly, constantly, every 10 minutes almost of every single day, I was lighting up a cancer stick. It didn't matter that my little children were in the room. I'd have one cigarette, right, burning in an ashtray, say, in the living room. And then I can remember at times, many times, one of my kids, little kids running up to me saying, Mom, Mom, you have a cigarette burning in the bathroom. And I'm like, oh, my God, you know, I was really, really into this addiction. I was all the way in, you know, and back then I was very good at, how do you say it? I was very good at justifying my use of nicotine. I would say to myself and to other people, well, you guys don't understand. I went through a really abusive marriage. You know, I was physically, verbally, spiritually abused. You guys just don't get it. You know, I was really hurt, and I need these cigarettes. I have a right to smoke. I defended my right to smoke. I argued with people. You know, I can't even tell you how many times I was asked to leave someone's home or thrown out because I refused to not smoke. You know, I went to great lengths to feed my addiction. And, yeah, I hurt myself more than anyone else ever really hurt me. I hurt myself, you know, and all the while I thought I was covering up and dealing with pain, and really I was just only masking a lot of my pain and my emotions and my feelings, and this just went on and on and on. But I became very good at, you know, falling on the pity pot, you know, self-pity, you know, and that stuff I didn't learn until later on coming into Nicotine Anonymous that was all spiritual suicide. I was committing spiritual suicide on myself long before I even knew it. But I went on, and I was smoking like crazy. I was smoking like a chimney. You know, nothing else mattered to me. I can remember times where I would neglect paying an electric bill because I wanted to make sure I had enough money for nicotine, right? I can remember stealing money from my mother's purse as an adult woman. I'm going in to visit her, and I'm stealing money from her purse to make sure that I have enough money for nicotine. I can remember getting in my vehicle, driving from the state of Illinois over into the next state, over in Wisconsin, so that I could get nicotine at a cheaper price. I did everything that I had to do to feed this addiction, and this went on for a very long time until something happened in 2002. My oldest son, who is no longer with us, may God rest his soul, but Rashid was about 22 years old at the time, and this was, I believe, 2001 or late 2002. He gave me a book. He and his girlfriend brought me this Christmas present. He was living out in New York City at the time and just really enjoying his life, but he was tired of me and my crap, and he had started. See, unlike me, my children, and they started very early. They were very verbal. They were very expressive. They didn't hold back. You know, they weren't afraid to tell me just how they felt, you know, and this happened before they were adults. But my Rashi told me at 22 years old, he said, you know what, Ma? I love you, and you're a wonderful lady. You're a very smart, sweet lady, but I'm really just getting tired of you and this nicotine, man. It's like you've gotten clean from the other drugs. You've stopped drinking, but you're still holding on to this nicotine like a dope fiend. And I'm telling you, that hurt me so bad, but it was the truth. It was the honest to God's truth. You know, and that's why I very proudly cop to that identification today, and I announce at every meeting that I am a grateful recovering nicotine junkie. Before I became grateful, though, I was a junkie. I'm still a junkie, a nicotine junkie. And anyway, my son gave me this book, and I don't talk about this a whole lot, but I have to tell you guys, I want to tell you, I was given this book by a gentleman named Alan Carr, and the book is called The Easy Way to Stop Smoking. My son sent me this book from New York City, and I overlooked the book, and I thought to myself, well, obviously, he really is tired of me, and he's tired of my smoking, and he's tired of putting up with it, and I need to stop. I really need to stop. I mean, he wasn't the only one that had verbalized it for me. I had other people, my siblings, over the years had started to express their dismay with the way I was living my life. They had started to talk to me about being fed up with the nicotine and how I was prioritizing it. And, you know, my mother even told me, God rest her soul, Lulu, I'm just really worried about you. You know, you seem to really be in over your head with this nicotine. And so when I got that book, I decided, well, you know what? What do I have to lose? I had everything to lose. I had my life that was jangling. I'm telling you, I was just dangling. And I felt like I better do something. I felt like I was about to die. I was smoking so heavily. I was a chain smoker. Almost on a daily basis, I could feel chest pains. You know, I had started to get physical indications that it was time for me to arrest this disease, but I was still so locked up in it, I could not stop on my own. So when I got this book, I thought, well, geez, I know my son loves me is what I thought. I know darn well he loves me, but he has no idea how hard it is to stop. And I've been doing this for too long, and there's just no way I'm going to be able to do this. I'm just not going to be able to do it. Now, keep in mind, before I got that book, I had another family member reach out to me to try and get some sense through my thick skull. My sister Vicky, my youngest sister, she's a pharmaceutical sales rep. Anyhow, Vicky had sent me this nicotine gum that she was working with, taking around to a lot of doctors out there in Southern California, and she sent me boxes of that gum, boxes and boxes. And, you know, I tried it, and I thought, no, this is nasty. I don't like the way it tastes. I'm not going to be able to do that. You know, and I remember taking the nicotine gum and throwing it away. I wasn't ready to stop. You know, at that point, I don't think anything would have helped me, because in my mind, I was very much locked up. I was wrapped up in my disease. And so it didn't matter. You know, I had a couple of attempts after that. I wasn't serious about quitting, but there was something about this book. When I read Alan Carr's book, everything that he said in that book spoke directly to me, directly to my addiction. And he convinced me. I was convinced. I was sold halfway through reading the book. Now, I did not stop smoking until I finished the book, but halfway through Mr. Carr's book, I was convinced that it was time I bring this to an end. And so I went ahead and, you know, the thing I liked about the book was that he gives you permission to continue smoking while reading it, right? So there I am, I'm reading it and I'm facing all of this truth about my addiction, and I'm continuing to smoke, but I'm noticing with each and every cigarette that I continued to smoke started to taste really, really foul. The taste of nicotine started to leave me before I finished the book, and I didn't know what was going on. I really, really didn't. At that point, I wasn't questioning a whole lot, but I continued to read. I continued until I finished his book. I finished Alan Carr's book, guys. That was in January of 2002. No, I'm sorry. It was December of 2002 that I finished the book. In January of 2003, I continued smoking, but I'm telling you, it was like every time I lit up a cigarette, I would hear this guy's words. I would hear something he said in the book. And by the time February rolled around, I said, this is it. I felt like I could do it. Perhaps I could try. I was willing to try this time. For the first time in my life, in February of 2003, early February, I felt like maybe I can do this. maybe if I just really try and hang on to everything that this guy is talking about in the book, because I knew in my heart of hearts that he was telling the truth, that nicotine had never really done anything for me. It was all in my thinking. I deluded myself. I fooled myself. I deceived myself for more than 30 years thinking that nicotine was doing something for me, when really nicotine never had the power to do anything good for me. I'll put it that way. It was not doing anything good for me. So I set a quit date, right? I set a quit date for Valentine's Day 2003. I talked with my daughter. She was the only one at home at the time, the youngest child at home. And I said, you know what? I'm getting ready to stop smoking. And she looked at me. She had heard that before, right? So she, being the daughter that she is, very, very outspoken and sometimes a little bit too smart for her own good. But anyhow, she said, yeah, Ma, I've heard that before. And I don't know, there was something about when she said that to me, it infuriated the heck out of me. Even though it was true, I had said to people before, I had made false promises. I had talked about quitting. You know, I had talked the talk, but I had never really walked the walk. But I set that quit date, and I'm telling you, I decided I was going to give it up. February 14th of 2003, when I woke up that morning, Valentine's Day, I said, this is smoking anymore. Now, I had cigarettes in my pack, maybe four or five from the night before, because I went out hard. You know, I smoked all night long the night before. I was like, I'm going to get it in because I know that I'm quitting. So, you know, being the junkie that I am, I might as well just get it all out, right? So I smoked. I stayed up mostly all night smoking like a chimney, you know, one after the other. But the next day, I felt physically sick. Like I had, I don't know if you guys have ever smoked so much that you just felt really ill. I felt really, really ill that next morning. And that, the feeling that I had helped to fuel a fire. I felt like I had a fire deep inside and I needed and I wanted it. I wanted it. I wanted to prove all the people who had said to me before many times, yeah, right, Lulu, we've heard that before. I wanted to prove these guys wrong, but more so than anything, I wanted to show myself and I wanted to show my three children that I could do something finally good for myself. And that's how I looked at it. I said, maybe this isn't a whole lot to someone else, but to me it felt like I would be doing a lot to take care of myself, to put down the cancer sticks. And so by the grace of God, I had my last cigarette. It was early morning, February 14, 2003, and when I look at my quit meter here, that shows a little more than 16 years since I've had a cancer stick, and I'm very grateful for that. But, you know, I have to be honest, because this is an honest program here, Nicotine Anonymous. When I stopped smoking, I still knew, I didn't feel like I was going to smoke again, but I just felt like I'm not going to be able to keep this up unless I have some support. Now, mind you, the people around me, my children who were closest to me than anyone has ever been, they were very supportive of me. Rashid was out in New York. He would call me almost daily. Every other week I'd get a little card, the cutest little card in the mail from him and his girlfriend, Jenny. They'd send me boxes of candy and gum and just all kinds of inspiration. And people were being supportive, right? But I felt like these guys don't really get it. because there I was, finally, I had put the nicotine down. I'm talking 2 months off nicotine. I went cold turkey. I didn't use any gum. I didn't use any patches. I didn't use e-cigs. I don't even know about e-cigs. I went cold turkey, but I felt like I was going to need more to keep it up, because even though I wasn't smoking, right, my brain was still saying, yeah, it looks good, and it, you know, it sounds good and everything, but you know, you're not going to be able to do this too long without me. I kept getting those kind of messages. You know, my brain kept talking, my junkie kept talking to me inside saying, yeah, we'll see how long you can keep this up. And I got scared, man. I remember crying one night to my daughter. She said, Mom, as much as I love you, I believe you know best. If you need support, then you're going to have to figure out something. You're going to have to do something. And, you know, I prayed about it and prayed about it. And one day I got on the computer. Long story short, I ended up getting on the computer and I found Nicotine Anonymous. And I was freaking out. I said, oh my goodness. You mean, now keep in mind, and some of you know because I've already mentioned it, I had been around 12-step programs before. I went into Cocaine Anonymous. I went into Alcoholics Anonymous. But I had no idea that there was anything called Nicotine Anonymous. And when I found that, I felt like somebody's hearing my prayers. Somebody is listening to me. Somebody wants me to stay sober. Somebody wants me to keep going. I started to feel like at that point, there must be purpose for me. There is hope. And I reached out to Nicotine Anonymous. Wow. Wow. You talk about a real eye-opener. When I first came into this program, there were people, I met folks who had been off nicotine 3, 4, 5 years, and I would get excited by that, you know. I would, on one hand, I would sit in the room, and I'll be honest with you, I was a little threatened. I felt threatened by some of these guys, because I would think, well, you know, shit, I'm sorry, she's been sober now for 3 years or 4 years. That's a lot of time. I don't know if I can do that. I don't know if I'm made to last that long. I would entertain these negative thoughts and such, but I kept going. I because they told me, and they were so nice and so welcoming. Every time I went to a meeting, they'd say, keep coming back. And I would think, wow, that's pretty cool. People don't usually invite me back anywhere, you know, because this is that same woman, that same girl that used to steal to feed her addiction. You know, this is that same girl that was asked to leave because she would start an argument with someone about smoking. So I wasn't used to people inviting me back in such a kind way. And so I thought, you know what, I'm just going to keep going. I'm going to keep going. And I must have attended Nick A for about 6 months straight before I got the courage to talk. I always felt like I had something I wanted to say. Always. But I always felt, too, that I didn't have a right to really voice what I really wanted to say. Because, again, and I'm not blaming her, I'm not blaming anyone, but this is just how I was raised. You know, my mother was a very strong woman, but she did not feel as though she had the right to voice her feelings. You know, she stuffed a lot of her feelings, but you know, that's just how it was. My mother was she wasn't a nicotine user. She was a tobacco chewer. And my dad, I forgot to tell you guys, my dad was a heavy cigar smoker. So I wasn't really used to that. And they said, just keep coming back. And, you know, they said things to me like, keep it simple. And, you know, don't worry about it. Don't try to complicate it. Just keep coming back. And I kept coming back. I kept coming back. And I got to talking with the lady one day after a meeting. I noticed this woman would hang around after the meetings. And so I went up to her and I asked her if she could sponsor me because I didn't know what I was doing. I really didn't understand the program. And she said, well, let me ask you, to what length are you willing to go? I will never forget that. She looked me dead in the eye and said, what length are you willing to go? And I said, willing to go for what? She said, what length are you willing to go, Lulu, to stay smoke-free? And I said, I'm willing to do anything. And I started crying. I said, I'm willing to do anything. And it just like all of this truth and all of these feelings just poured out there at that basement church that day. I started crying and I told her. I mean, I really opened up to this woman. There I was doing almost a fourth and fifth step with her, but I told her I was just tired of living the way that I had been living. I was tired of nicotine having the control over me. I felt like I had turned into a person that I did not want to be. I did not believe that that was the person I was put on this earth to be, to lie, to steal, to connive, to mislead people. I mean, I had just turned into a real monster. Nicotine, you know, I was just walking around a real mess, you know, and I didn't know that nicotine was a drug. I didn't know that I was addicted either until the drugs ran out, you know, but I begged this woman really to sponsor me, and she turned me down the first time. She turned me down. She said she didn't believe that I had the willingness, and she would just have to see. And I thought, okay. My feelings were hurt, you know, because I came into the program with a really big ego. You know, I was hurt, and I did not let that stop me, though. Part of me was really hurt. The other part of me was like, okay, I'll show you, because I don't want to go back to smoking. Here I am going on 3 months off nicotine. I did it cold turkey. I started getting a little cocky, right? I was like, I'll show her. And I must have showed up at every single meeting that they had. I mean, I did well past 90 and 90. I was there so much. I was in this woman's face. I was following her. I was just like on her coattail. Eventually, she said, Lulu, I think you're ready. And so we ended up having one of the most beautiful relationships, and this is bittersweet for me because this woman, Gail, I'll never ever forget her. She sponsored me for all of 10 years, and then she passed away because of a nicotine-related death. You know, she quit for many, many years. She had been sober and smober for almost 30 years, but there's something about the damage that was done before getting clean, and it came back. So that was tough for me. I went a couple of months without a sponsor there, but soon enough, I got another woman in the fellowship, and you know, I just started listening and doing what people were telling me. You know, it wasn't really that big of a deal. Now that I look back on it, I made things a lot more difficult than they really ever had to be. Just like the nicotine, I gave nicotine far much more power than it ever had. I learned in this program through working the steps one day at a time that oftentimes I can still complicate things that really just don't even need to be complicated. But it's very difficult when you grow up in a family and you have that kind of impression. You are influenced year after year to one way of being. It's very difficult to break that. It is very difficult to break that. I am still working on it. I'm still a work in progress. But I tell you, when I found Nick A, I knew that I had the support that I need. And I don't say needed, but the support that I need, because it's still there. And I'm just so grateful because this program, the 12 steps, working the 12 steps, working along with a sponsor and other people in this program has given me back my life. I remember early on someone told me, if you work this program the way that it was intended, you should never find it necessary to use another cancer stick. And I truly believe that. I truly believe that in my heart, deep down in my soul, because since I have been off nicotine, I have met with some very difficult times, as I'm sure you guys have all met with. Just because you stop smoking doesn't mean that life stops happening. In 2008, I lost my precious Rashid, my oldest son, the one that gave me the Alan Carr book, to a very tragic death, a suicide that I didn't see coming. That was something that will forever be difficult for me to explain. I didn't see it coming. I wasn't ready for it. Even if I had had an indication that it was coming, I don't think that any parent is ever ready to bury their own child. And when I found myself there making arrangements to bury my kid without ever once thinking of nicotine, without ever once thinking, maybe if I had a drink, maybe if I could pick up a drink, or maybe if I had a hit of cocaine or any drug, maybe if I had any of that. I didn't have any of those thoughts, not one single one. And that wasn't because I'm a strong lady. That's because I have a strong faith in a God of my understanding that is much stronger, much more powerful than me or any other human being that I know. This program works. You know, you guys hear that all the time. I hear that. The program works when we work it. It really does. It really does. Since losing my son, I have also lost my mother. She was my best friend, my sweet little mom. She was 85 years old when she passed away, though she was in very good health. Alzheimer's and dementia would claim her life. I've also helped bury my father since I have been sober. My dad died of a massive heart attack brought on by many years of smoking. I've lost two brothers due to this addiction. I don't think I need to tell you guys that I know, and I don't want to sound cocky or anything, but I know that nicotine can do nothing for me other than make things worse. You know, in other words, if I'm confronted with or faced with a problem today, nicotine can only make it worse. That's it. By the grace of God, I haven't had a craving for nicotine in more than 10 years. I asked the God that I believe in to take my obsession for nicotine away, and I believe that he really has. Does that mean that I'm cured? No, I don't even believe that there's a cure for my disease of addiction. I only have today. All I can do is stay in today, not use nicotine no matter what comes across my table. All I have is a daily reprieve. But I'm very grateful that I've been given a second chance, because I, not only family members, I've lost many friends. Quite a few were in this program. They were members of Nicotine Anonymous. So I keep in mind on a daily basis that I'm still eligible. You know, I'm a nicotine junkie. I'm still eligible. I don't take this program for granted. Sometimes I've been accused of being too serious about my program. Well, I have to be, because I was a serious junkie. I was a serious active user and abuser of nicotine. I have no other recourse, no other choice other than to embrace the 12 steps of this program one day at a time. And I do that best by working with other people. You know, if I don't do anything else right, guys, I feel like I have to remember step one. We admitted we were powerless over nicotine and that our lives had become unmanageable. I've spoken to you tonight about some of the unmanageability in my life. Things have gotten a lot better, a heck of a lot better, but there is still some unmanageability. I still have character defects. I still have flaws, shortcomings. I'm far from perfect. I don't even want to be perfect. That just sounds like too big of a deal for me. You know, that's something that but I do believe in progress one day at a time. And I make progress best by practicing step 12, working with other people, after having had a spiritual awakening as the result of the previous steps. I try to carry this message to nicotine users and to practice the principles in all my affairs. I have to. That's what keeps me sober. I have to do it, regardless of how I'm feeling. You know, I'm going to be honest with you. I had a thought that I might cancel doing the speaker share tonight because I was thinking I had a headache earlier. I had someone to call me at the last minute and ask me to pick them up. And I had to drive out of my way over into Dallas, which isn't far away, but that wasn't on my list of things to do today, right? So I got a little attitude about it, but I went ahead and did it. And I thought, you know what? No, go and give your speaker share. Just go and do what you need to do, because I saw that as my disease trying to trick me. Even at 17 years almost in this program, my disease is still on my shoulder. At times, I feel like it's still on my shoulder doing push-ups, just waiting. And it's patient. My disease is very patient, waiting for me to get to that point where I feel like, this is a piece of cake. I don't need to practice those steps anymore. I've done that. You know, I don't need to talk to my sponsor today. I don't need to go to meetings. I still have thoughts to come up like that. That is my disease of addiction. I suffer from a disease, and I learned in this program that there's no chemical solution to my problem. I had a spiritual problem. I still have a spiritual problem, but because of the 12 steps, I've gotten a lot closer to the person that I really am. That woman that I told you guys about, the one that was lying and stealing and manipulating and doing any and everything she had to do just to keep up with the addiction, that wasn't me. My addiction was in control then. My disease of addiction. And I have to thank the God of my understanding for delivering me from that. I've made amends. I continue to make amends to those that I've hurt. My children, my two living children, Xavier is now 40 years old, Ishaya, she's 37. They're very, very much a part of my life today. They are very happy for me that I am in recovery finally, you know, and I'm very proud of the fact that my children still accept me into their lives, because I work with women today whose family members have pretty much just given up. You know, they've been there and done that and they're tired of it. So I'm very grateful that my children are still open-minded and still loving and still there and supportive. And like I said a little while ago, this program works. You look around this room, you see the number of people here who have stopped smoking, who are doing really well. And I'm not just talking about the old-timers in the room. Many of the newcomers, relatively new to this program, are not smoking. And that's what attracted me in the beginning to Nicotine Anonymous. People were coming in talking about how they are living their lives now without any nicotine at all. And I'm still excited by this program. I hope and pray to the God of my understanding that I will always be excited about this program, because I learned the hard way. I'm either working on recovery or I'm going to be working on a relapse. And I gotta be honest, I much prefer recovery. I think the time that I spent in active addiction was enough. It was truly enough. This old girl, I'm getting old, guys. I'm 62 years old by the grace of God. I don't believe that I have another quit in me. I might have another relapse or two, considering I'm a big nicotine junkie, right? But I seriously doubt that I have another quit left in me. So this is it. This is it. I have to do. It's do or die. And with that, I'm going to thank each and every one of you for sticking in there with me. I know I was all over the board tonight, but that's the best that I have. And you guys mean the world to me. You guys here at Von R, I just want you to know you really, really do mean a lot to me. And I thank each and every one of you for being a part of my recovery one day at a time. And thank you, Kenny, for asking me to speak. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you all so very much.